Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. On Midnight in Karachi, writer Andrew Smith, whose most recent novel is The Alex Crow, and his earlier novels include Winger and Grasshopper Jungle, which is a 2015 Prince Honor book and the winner of a Kitschies Award earlier this year too. Andrew, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you very much, Mavish.
Congratulations on the awards that Grasshopper Jungle has racked up. I read recently that it wasn't originally meant for publication. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I at the time when I wrote the novel, I was very kind of disenchanted with the business of publishing and writing, and so I decided to step away. But I had no intention of stopping writing. I just didn't want to be a writer anymore. And so it was the summer of 2011, and my son, I just deposited my son off for his first year away, far away from home at university. And so I started writing this thing, which I had no intention of showing to anybody. And then along comes Michael Barrett, a literary agent who had also become my friend. And he talked me into letting him see what I'd been working on in secret. And then he insisted that he represent the work and bring it to the public's eye.
So that's how it found its way into our grubby paws.
I guess so. Michael Barrett can talk anybody into anything, I think.
Well, tell me a little bit about the premise of this and where that came from.
It's hard to really pin down what the premise is and the origins of it. I mean, I knew that at the time that I was kind of, you know, I was kind of writing this a manifesto of all of the things that I was disappointed in about the world and how precarious our position is as far as the continuation of our species. And so I wanted to write a novel about the end of the world that also examines other things, more kind of global ideas like the connection that we all have with one another and the impact of, you know, reckless science and, you know, falsely conceived missions, military missions around the world, and then put this all together in some kind of strange way that deals with a very small town in the American Midwest that's undergoing this transformation or this kind of this serious decline.
Was Grasshopper Jungle meant to be a graphic novel? Will it still be one day?
I've always enjoyed drawing, and I did start off drawing Grasshopper Jungle as a graphic novel, but it's so time consuming and it's so difficult. And the amount of time it takes me to draw one page of comic panels, I could probably write about 20 pages of text. And so, you know, I really kind of fell in love with the story that I'd begun telling, and so I decided to just concentrate on the text. There are a lot of illustrations that I've done and friends of mine have done while I was kind of developing this as an idea, and I can't really say whether or not it will one day become a graphic novel. I'd really like to see that happen, and I am working on a graphic novel right now, in conjunction with the other stuff that I'm working on.
Now, I know that Grasshopper Jungle is going to be a movie, isn't it? Do you get to be a part of that at all?
Well, I think I've been a part of it since the beginning, because the way the whole film deal came about was that originally the screenwriter, Scott Rosenberg, who's a very highly acclaimed screenwriter, he read the novel and then he contacted me and told me that this was a novel that he felt like he must adapt into a screenplay. And then Scott went to the heads of Sony and Universal, and both of those studios were very eager and enthusiastic about picking up the project just because Scott was going to write it. And then we decided to go with Sony, and then somebody at Sony sent a copy of the novel to the director, Edgar Wright. And then Edgar contacted me and said, hey, I read Grasshopper Jungle. I really liked it. And would you like to go out to dinner? So I went out to dinner with Edgar Wright. And so we've had meetings at Sony with the producer, Matt Tolmach, and Edgar Wright, the director, and Scott Rosenberg. And we've had really lengthy discussions about how things should be handled and, you know, and what their ideas for the film would be. So it's a really good teamwork kind of environment.
And you must be really excited about it.
I am. My whole life is so surreal. So I try to not get too excited about too many things. And I'm not generally an excitable guy, but this is something that's really neat.
You write the books you do and you say you're not generally an excitable guy.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, you know, the books that I write, when I start off writing them, it's for me, the mission is to try to do something that nobody else is doing or that nobody else will do, and something that would interest me. And so if I give myself that kind of task at the outset, then I can't pretty much help but come up with things that are pretty wild and outrageous.
And that's a good way to go about writing, really. I mean, set your own standards, right, instead of comparing to things that are happening around you.
Well, I'm definitely not a reactive writer in terms of, you know, trying to seek out what trends are currently being, you know, elevated. But and it is challenging, but I like challenges, and I really truly only write for myself. And thankfully, my audience has really good taste.
Now, let's move on to your most recent novel, The Alex Crow. Will you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Sure. The Alex Crow, like Grasshopper Jungle, weaves together multiple storylines. But instead of starting at the center and then kind of exploding out in a lot of different directions, The Alex Crow starts in very disjointed, in terms of time and space, storylines that ultimately will come together at the very end. And really, the story was informed by immigrant kids that I work with here in the United States. And a few years ago, I started receiving kids who were basically refugees from Syria. And I was so inspired, and I found their stories so compelling about how they had left their country and then found themselves, you know, going from one type of insanity, what was going on in Syria, into another type of insanity, being in Southern California with California kids in the United States of America in the 21st century. And so I wanted to tell that kind of a story about a kid who goes from this very, very insane background and finds himself in just an equally, but in a different degree, insane environment here in the United States. And then there are also, you know, the other storylines involve a failed expedition to discover an open seaway to the North Pole in the 1880s. This was actually based on a true story. A schizophrenic bomber who thinks he's talking to Joseph Stalin, and the reintroduction of formerly extinct species into the environment, in particular one, a crow who's named Alex, who's not very happy about being brought back to life.
Who is, really?
I know, you know, it's, I mean, I think that extinction is the natural course of events, and it might be like a really, really nice nap that you don't want to be woken up from.
Right. Well, you know what? Every time you talk about somebody being brought back from life who was pissed off, I think of Buffy. Because, you know, that was my classic example of somebody who really didn't need to be brought back to life. But, you know, for selfish reasons, for other people's selfish reasons, she was. But anyway, let's go back to The Alex Crow. I read an interview just a couple of days ago where you were talking about The Alex Crow, and you said it's sort of about the failure of male-dominated societies, which I found really interesting because, of course, you know, if you talk about the failure of any kind of society, that's kind of cross-cultural and goes across all sorts of international boundaries, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was one of the ideas that I wanted to explore in The Alex Crow, because I think that, you know, the idea is even presented that, you know, that, it, you know, if when human beings become extinct, it's probably going to be because of a really dumb idea that a bunch of men thought was actually a good idea before they implemented it. And so Ariel, who's the protagonist, the main character, the primary narrator in The Alex Crow, he goes through many experiences in male-dominated societies, and every one of them is just insane. It's crazier and crazier, and they all really fundamentally, at their core, fail, as does the male society of the expedition on the ship that was called the Alex Crowe as well.
Now, I was reading an interview you did with Publishers Weekly some years ago about your novel, The Marbury Lens. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Right, yes.
Which begins as a sort of realistic novel about child abuse, and then you know, the lens leads them to a more sort of fantastical world. You talked about how you had, when you were a child, been kidnapped by a complete stranger. I wonder if you'd be open to talking about that and how it affected you and your writing later in life, because I can't imagine a writer's work not being affected by something so huge and so traumatic.
Well, there's nothing that I write that isn't somehow a manifestation of my own experiences. And so my writing is really personal. And with the Marbury Lens, I wanted to kind of examine the burden of guilt and self-blame that victims kind of carry with them and for the rest of their lives, and also how intensely this burden kind of affects Jack's, the main character's, perception of reality and where he really is. So the Marbury Lens is, you know, it's really on one level, it's really psychologically speculative, and on another level, it's just kind of a really bizarre, out there science fiction thriller, I guess.
You're really, really prolific. A couple of books a year, kind of prolific, which is, you know, an insanely, it's quite a large number. A couple of books, three books in a year and a half or so. Is that what it was?
I'm sorry. The word insane is absolutely the best word.
I meant it in the nicest way possible.
It's true. It's been, especially now, because, I mean, it's one thing to write a couple of books in a year, but it's another thing entirely to actually put out a couple of books in a year. Because when you combine all of the editorial processes and the touring and the other pressures that are put on the author, it becomes a real test of endurance. And thankfully, I think things are going to slow down for me a little bit now.
But do you just have crazy discipline, or are you just really, really fast when it comes to writing, or both?
Yeah, I don't think that I'm particularly fast, but I do think that discipline is an absolute key for any writer, and to be self-disciplined and to be able to say, yes, I'm going to sit down now and I'm going to do some work. The other thing, too, I think, is that in my process of writing, I do not draft. So I think I'm very meticulous about how I put things together, and I'm very conscious about the details as I'm going through. I'm not a blow it all out and then go back and fix your errors kind of person. So maybe in the overall scheme of things, maybe that does make me a fast writer, because when I get to that last page and I hit that last character mark, that's right when I send it in to my agent and my editor.
So that still sounds pretty organized, though, even though you're saying that you make sure all the detailing and everything is done in that one, and you write one draft from like beginning to end, right?
That's correct. And I don't outline, and I don't pre-plot. I just go from the beginning to the end. And even with, you know, storylines that are as disjointed and as far apart as the storylines in Grasshopper Jungle or The Alex Crowe, this is how I wrote those books too, straight through, without concentrating on one part and then splicing it in.
And do you find they remain that way up till publication, or is there a lot of back and forth with the editors and the change process?
Structurally, they remain that way up to publication. Working with my editor on both of these books is Julie Strauss Gable. And I think that working with her really, really improved me as a writer. All of my editors have, but she's got to be the greatest and also at the same time most difficult editor, most demanding editor that there is to work with. And I really love working with her.
Now, do you still teach high school? You were just talking about some of your students from whom you had sort of been inspired to write The Alex Crowe. Are you still teaching high school students?
I'm still teaching high school. I don't know how long that's going to continue. One of the biggest reasons that I'm still teaching is that my daughter attends school at the high school where I teach, but this is her last year and she'll be graduating in June. And then I think I need to really kind of like step back and look at what my goals are for the next part of my life and what I want to be doing. The most difficult thing in leaving that profession would be distancing myself or separating myself from my students, because they're really what keeps me going.
Yeah.
And I love working with kids.
This is what I was going to ask, is does that help being around teenagers when writing about them? Does it help you in your fiction, or does it throw up almost sort of too much noise into whatever it is that you've got in your head?
Well, there's never too much noise, but that's why I start writing early in the morning, so that my head doesn't get too saturated with, you know, with kind of white noise. But the students really help me a lot, and they really keep me in touch with the way things are right now. And I can read young adult novels that are written by young writers, basically, and I can tell right away whether or not that author actually has interaction with a broad spectrum of young people, or whether they're just kind of writing something that's secondhand experience based on things that they've read or things that they see on television or movies, which is kind of, it's kind of a tell for me. It's a tell sign about whether or not authors are really in touch with the people that they're writing about.
And sometimes the people they're writing for as well.
Right. And again, you know, I don't consider myself to be someone who writes for teenagers. I consider myself to be someone who writes about adolescence, and I certainly want people of all ages to read my books, but I'm not an age level YA author. I'm what I consider to be a genre YA author, and there're going to be people who argue with that distinction, but but I'm not someone who imagines an audience of people between the ages of 12 and 18, for example.
Being a teenager can be dark, and it can be mysterious, and it can be wonderful, and also very frightening, I think, especially in the world we live in today. I mean, I have a daughter, and I worry about the closer she's getting to her teenage years, because I feel like the world has changed so much from when I was her age, and it was tough enough back then. I feel like you capture that fear really well in your novels and in your young male characters, but I can guess that there are people who do find your work too dark or too strange or too frightening. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say then they should pick up something that's lighter and not so strange and not so frightening. There are definitely dark elements that run through, in varying degrees, all of my body of work. But I think that, you know, that's something that everybody experiences. And especially when people experience that during their adolescence, I think that, you know, the magnitude of the impact of emotional events during adolescence is probably far greater than it is in any other stage in your life.
All right, so what's next for you? Have you already written your next two books?
Well, I do have a novel coming out in September from Simon & Schuster. It's called Standoff, Simon & Schuster in the U.S., Penguin in the U.K. It's called Standoff, and it's the sequel to Winger. And then I'm currently working on a 2016 title for Julie Strauss-Gabel at Dutton.
So I was right. You have written the next couple of novels.
I've got the next one, and I'm into the one after that. So, yeah, and I'm working on, like I said, I'm working on a graphic novel, very slowly working on a graphic novel, just for fun.
So now, if you were headed into a bunker for the foreseeable future, and you could take, maybe three novels with you that you'd have to read again and again and again, what would they be?
Wow, that's a tough choice, but they would be Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut, Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, and, wow, this is going to sound really terrible, Grasshopper Jungle by Andrew Smith.
Really? Would you read your work again and again for the rest of your life if you had to?
Sure. I mean, like every time I open up a book that I'd written in the past and I look at a page, it's kind of like time travel, because I go back to that person who I was when I was writing that page. And it's a really interesting experience for me, and I like it. The other thing, too, is that I just yesterday finished listening to the audio version of the Alex Crowe. And this is something that I've never been able to do with any of my books, is listen to them on audiobook. I'll start, but then I can't handle hearing somebody else reading my words aloud. But the Alex Crowe, the audio version of the Alex Crowe, I just thought it was wonderful, and I didn't want it to end. And who knows, I might even listen to it again, all 8 hours of it.
So you've been writing for a while. You've got a whole bunch of books under your belt. You look back at everything you've done. Is there anything you'd do a different way?
I don't think so. I think that I did things the right way. And there wasn't a lot of pressure on me in my career, because I never started out with this idea that I must be published and I must get this thing out there and I must become a writer. I never had that idea at all. I'd been writing my entire life, and then I got kind of basically dared into trying to submit something. And so I submitted it and it got published. And then I was scared, because I never wanted anybody to read the stuff that I was writing. But then here I found myself with a publishing contract to one of the major houses in New York City. And then the whole thing kind of snowballed. So my story is very unique, I think, in comparison to a lot of other published authors.
So, Andrew, recently there was a big conversation about a certain interview you did, and a lot of hype was created. A lot of tweets were sent out. Do you want to talk about what happened there?
Sure. I mean, this is actually the first time that I've had an opportunity to speak about this publicly, because throughout this whole thing, nobody ever asked me. And unfortunately, I think that there was a lot of misinformation and a lot of misinterpretation of what I said. Unlike this interview, the interview that I was quoted in wasn't taped. And I think that I was kind of not quoted extremely accurately. But the idea that I was trying to convey to the journalist who had asked these questions was the idea that I write from experience. And I was born in a household that only had boys. And so, of course, my stories that are very personal, as I've said earlier in this interview, draw on a lot of personal experience. And I have this fear of representing somebody and not getting something right. And so if my stories seem, or my protagonists at least, seem to be, you know, very male kind of, American-ish kinds of guys. Well, that's just because that's who I am. You know, the interviewer kept coming back to this place asking about whether or not women had access points into what I was writing simply because my protagonists tend to be males. And I thought that was, you know, he kept kind of trying to push this idea of females not being able to read my work or not connecting with my work for whatever reasons. And I was trying to be as polite as possible during the interview. But at the same time, the whole questioning line was pretty off base. It was just completely wrong, because most of my readers, I think the majority of my readers, happen to be female. And so the conflagration that came out of this quote about my own personal experiences was kind of, I think, kind of unwarranted, and also at times got to be pretty cruel on all sides. And it's something that, you know, that I tried to distance myself from as much as possible. And it's something that was, you know, that was really distressing to me and my family.
No, absolutely. I can see that. Mm-hmm. And I do find it strange that somebody would insist on asking you or any writer whether they thought that female readers were attracted to or interested in their work, because why would, I mean, it's the same as saying that, you know, boys don't want to read about girls, girls don't want to read about boys. It seems rather binary, and the world isn't like that, really.
Right, and it's just an absurd claim. And a lot of the people who came out and expressed critical, you know, some kind of critical awareness of my body of work were just simply wrong. I mean, as I've said, I have my 10th novel is coming out later on this year. And over the, you know, if you look at the body of my work, there are all kinds of multidimensional, interesting, good and bad and kind and not compassionate female characters in my books that I think reflect you know, again, the broad spectrum of humanity that's out there. And again, there was just, I'm just really, really just baffled by a lot of the comments and a lot of the assumptions that were made. And I think that sometimes those assumptions that are made on the basis of 140 characters or less can be just so troublingly wrong.
Right. I mean, I admit I was quite personally baffled by it as well, simply because I do think that if, well, as far as I was concerned, you were saying that, look, this is perhaps something I admit I need to work on. I don't think there's anything wrong with a writer saying that for anything, whether it be about X, you know, kind of characters or structure or whatever it is, voice. And so I think a writer admitting or saying, sure, I'll work on this. I mean, I would applaud that personally.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, again, I'm a father of a teenage girl. And yes, and I think that I can say what sexism is, and I might be wrong, but I'm not a sexist, and I really can't understand the degree of outrage and offense that people took at that, again, that poorly misquoted quote that I gave in an interview earlier.
What's strange to me is I kept thinking, you know, some people are good at certain things, as far as writers are concerned. Some people are good at the other, you know. So if you're better at writing the experience of young teenage boys, that's okay too. Do you know what I mean? I mean, not every writer can be as perfect at every aspect of the world. And I don't see the fault in that.
We need diverse books, right? And
right.
I mean, if we truly had diverse books that were, you know, in which a reader would see a reflection of himself or herself, then we'd probably need to put out about 7.5 billion books per year, because, you know, everyone's unique and everyone deserves to have a voice and to have a face and be represented.
And I can sit here as a woman who grew up in 1980s military curfew Karachi and still really like the kids in Grasshopper Jungle. But I'm glad we spoke about this, Andrew.
I'm glad we did too. And I hope that there's no backlash against you.
Oh, we'll just have to wait and see. I'm in a bunker in Karachi, Andrew. I'll be fine. I've seen worse.
All right. Do you have room in there for me?
Sure. Come on over.
Okay.
Bring the whole family. What the hell? Bring your 3 books, okay? Don't forget those.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much, Mavesh.
Under the Radar on Midnight in Karachi. Musharraf Ali Faruqi is a Pakistani writer and translator. His novels include The Fantastic Story of a Widow and Between Clay and Dust. And he has translated both Dastan-e-Amir Hamza and Hoshruba, an early Urdu fantasy epic which is going to be serialized right here on Tor.com. Just a little heads up, there are times that the audio may bubble up a bit, but it's just for a few seconds, so please bear with it. Musharraf, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you, Mavesh. Thank you for doing this.
Now, let's talk about Hoshruba. It's said to be the first ever Urdu fantasy epic. It's vast, it's magnificent, and you spent quite a few years, I know, translating some of it into English. How did you come to know about this, and why did you choose to translate it?
This legend, this fantasy epic, which I consider the world's first magical fantasy epic, was written in 1883, transcribed in 1883, between 1883 and 1893, but it was in the oral tradition for a very long time. We don't know yet how long it has been in the making and how long it was told before it was transcribed. So, but I, an abridged version prepared for kids when I was young, and this is part of the longer Adventures of Amir Hamza cycle, which I had also translated. And one of the reasons for translating the Adventures of Amir Hamza was to provide the background story for Hoshruba, because Hoshruba was my real target translation. So the Adventures of Amir Hamza was a step along the way towards, you know, providing a background for the story, and that was the central legend from which the Hoshruba grew. So it was very important to translate Amir Hamza first, and Hoshruba is the next step and the real work.
How difficult was the work? How difficult was the translation process? I mean, this is, as you said, you know, ancient. It wasn't written in the modern version of Urdu that you and I speak, or that anyone on the subcontinent speaks. It couldn't have been easy to go back and translate it.
No, it wasn't. And the problem is compounded because we do not have modern text published since the time this was first published in 1883-1893. So usually what happens with classical text in any normal body of literature is that it's, edited texts are made from the original texts, and you provide a whole apparatus of a critical apparatus with it, which helps, anybody studying the text, and also helps by the same token the translators doing it. But unfortunately for Hoshoba, this was not the case because for some reason our critics thought that these old fantasies, these great legends, were somehow keeping them from moving to a modern embrace, the embrace of modern literature, which in their mind was the novel and the short story. So these legends and fantasies just were overlooked, and no work was done on them until very recently.
How did you go about getting it published? That's what I'm interested in, because as you said, people weren't necessarily willing to look at this. It wasn't a modern text. It wasn't what people were at that point looking to from translated literature, Urdu into English. Then to go out and say, hey, why don't you publish this massive fantasy epic that no one's even had a version of since the 19th century? What kind of reception did that get?
It got wonderful reviews, both in the academic press in the US and in the news media in Pakistan and India, because the legend was alive in the memory of people, and it was the first introduction to them for the Western audience. And it helped that the background legend, The Adventures of Mir Hamza, was available for people to read, which was published from Modern Library in 2007. But the work itself is long and tedious. There will be 24 volumes, projected 24 volumes in this work. This is the serialization that we are going to start seeing on Tor.com. is of the first of those 24 volumes. And I broached Tor.com with this idea, and they very kindly agreed to run it. And this, I think, will help a lot of new readers find this fantasy, because nothing like this has been available as a comparison from the East, a great magical fantasy legend, which nobody has heard about until recently, which was unknown to people because it simply was not translated into any language. So this was its very first English language translation.
You say unknown to people, but then millions of us growing up in the subcontinent, of course, were... I mean, it was unknown perhaps internationally because there wasn't translation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
But millions of us in the subcontinent grew up with these stories, as you pointed out earlier. And now I think it'll be interesting to see how people react to them reading them in English, because, you know, it's weird. You read this stuff as an adult, and you've read the stories or heard the stories, as you said, a child's version growing up. You have a different perspective as an adult on them. I'm sure when you were translating them, were there things that you found or things that confounded you that perhaps as a child you had just accepted or not questioned?
Well, as I mentioned, I was reading an abridged text, which was a very simple sort of text. But as you look at this text in its original form, and you look at the narrative devices that are embedded in it, you are just stunned by the creativity of its creators, the storytellers, the dastan goes, as they are called in Urdu, who created this legend. They used a lot of available imagery. So you can say that the atmosphere they borrowed was from 19th century India. Then they took it to a realm which was completely fantastical. So you have things which may sound familiar or which may resemble historical buildings or the kind of dresses that people wore. But they are placed in a completely fantastic world. So there's a part which is familiar and a part which is completely unfamiliar.
All those other volumes, Musharraf, who's going to translate those?
I hope I'm going to do that. I'm currently working on the second one. It should be out by by May, by my estimation. But if the serialization continues, it will be starting sooner in the serialized form than we'll see it in the printed form. So that is happening, and there will be a link available where people can purchase the complete book if they are interested in it.
That's good to know that you haven't given up the translation and that we're going to see more of it soon.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
All right, thank you, Musharraf. Musharraf Ali Farooqi on Under the Radar on Midnight in Karachi today. The Hoshroba serialization starts today on Torah.com.